Next door to Israel, we have Lebanon, which is another little artificial state. The French created this little one. They cut it out of the mandate, separated it from Syria, made sure that it was a mishmash of Druze, Christians, Sunnis, Shias, and other minorities. The same old idea. Create a state which is balanced between different ethnic groups, where none actually has a majority, and then you can play one off against the other and dominate them from outside. That's the little present the French imperialists left. The British left the mess in Israel, Palestine, and the French left the mess in Lebanon. Very nice people, these imperialists, in the way they deal with these people. The Lebanon, therefore, has been subject to internal conflict ever since it was created. There was a civil war where something like 150,000 people died in a population of about 4 million. It was a devastating civil war. The Palestinian question further unbalanced the situation in Palestine, in Lebanon, because a part of the Palestinians fled to across the border into Lebanon and set up camps in the south, which became basis for the PLO, especially after the massacre in Jordan, after the massacre of 20,000 Palestinians at the hands of their Arab brothers, the Jordanian state. They fled, some of them fled to South Lebanon, and carried on their attacks against Israel in the south of Lebanon, which eventually provoked the invasion of Israel, and also provoked a reaction inside Lebanon by the Christians, for example. And there's the famous massacre of the Palestinians in the two camps of Sabra and Shatila, where the Israelis said, we had nothing to do with it. They just surrounded the camps and made sure nobody could get out, while the Christian militias went in and did the butcher's job. After that, the Syrians went into Lebanon. Now, because Syria was a deformed worker state and was part of the sphere of influence of the Soviet Union in the past, the Americans, especially this idiot Bush, didn't like the presence of the Syrians in Lebanon, blaming them for everything. Well, you see what they've done there. They forced Syria out. Syria's left. And they've got a marvellous position now, where instead of having strengthened the pro-Western regime in Lebanon, the Signora government, what they've done is they've strengthened Hezbollah. Because if you see what happened last year, and Hezbollah, by the way, came into being in the Lebanon during the last occupation 20 years ago as a resistance movement against the Israeli occupation. Iran has been backing Hezbollah and providing them with some nice little missiles that don't just get across the border but can hit Haifa, and some of them apparently could even hit Tel Aviv, which is a hell of a shock for the Israeli population, because in the past the Arabs would use pea shooters to hit them and then just get 5 or 10 kilometers across the border. Now Hezbollah is heavily armed. The Israeli army, powerful army, last year failed to get into Lebanon, and who stopped them? It was Hezbollah. Hezbollah has emerged much more strengthened in Lebanon, and therefore it's actually strengthened Iran and the enemies of American imperialism, not the friends. If they'd left the Syrians there, this wouldn't have happened. We're not saying that the Syrians are a nice regime, but even from the point of view of stability in the region, you see how Bush seems to be able to get everything wrong. The Signora government in Lebanon is a very weak government. It's based on the constitution of Lebanon is one of balances where the president has to be from one ethnic group, the vice president from another, and he has to rotate, and you have to have a certain balance in the government to try and appease all these minorities. But the policy of the government, the economic policy of the Lebanese government, is try and get Lebanon into the World Trade Organization, and to do that, apply IMF and World Bank policies, which is privatization, cuts, etc., the same policies that Israel is carrying out. By the way, and this has provoked general strikes in Lebanon, powerful general strikes in the country. Again, you can see there the class struggle also coming to the fore in this country. Egypt, which again we could have a separate discussion just on that. Egypt is a key country in the Middle East and in the whole of Africa, because it's one of the biggest in terms of population and also in terms of development, and most importantly the size of its working class. It has a semi-dictatorial regime. they have elections, but only certain parties can stand. Earlier this year, there was a massive wave of strikes. There is an article from the 23rd of April that you can read on the website for more detail on that. Hundreds of factories in struggle, factories being occupied, textile workers on strike, and actually winning their demands. This is in a country where if the state doesn't give its okay, you can't actually go on strike. But obviously, laws only function when people are prepared to obey them, and when the mass movement develops, obviously, you can't stop them going on strike just with a law. By the way, I don't want to divert too far away from this. Africa would also be worth discussing, but I can't open up that discussion. But massive wave of strikes in Egypt. Powerful general strike in Nigeria a few weeks ago. The most powerful general strike since the 1980s. Now, the comrades there were telling me how areas of Nigeria which normally don't take part in strikes were mobilized. In South Africa, the last few weeks, you've seen this powerful strike movement against the ANC government. So Africa also is beginning to move. The working class is moving. Morocco too, the comrades report, a wave of protest. But Egypt also is a worrying situation for imperialism, because the working class on the one hand is on the move, but what we've seen in more than one Arab country where there is no workers, genuine workers alternative, this kind of situation can open up room to the Islamic fundamentalists. And in Egypt they are developing and moving, and that would create serious problems for Israel. If Egypt were if the regime were to collapse and some kind of Islamic regime were to come to power, they have a border with Gaza, they would connect with Gaza, and it would create serious problems. In the past, Egypt was a problem for Israel. They had a war against Egypt, and the imperialism managed to buy off the regime in Egypt. If you go back into the history of the Nasser, Egypt was a country which had entered the sphere of influence of the Soviet Union, and it was moving in the direction of becoming a deform worker state with all the reforms they can. They never actually went that far. They went very far but didn't complete the process. Imperialism put huge pressure with aid, etc., etc., and managed to swing the regime back. And Mubarak it represents that. And so they've managed to basically create a kind of Western-friendly regime in Egypt, which is of immense use, obviously, to Israel. Saudi Arabia is another country we could talk about. They went into Iraq saying that it was because of Al-Qaeda, ignoring one little detail, that Al-Qaeda actually comes from Saudi Arabia. Bin Laden is a member of a very, very prominent family of the ruling class of Saudi Arabia. Well, there's a lot of Bin Ladens, there's lots of them, and they're very, very influential businessmen. They're flying across the Atlantic and doing business with the Americans, etc. But it's a brutal regime. It's an extremely important regime for imperialism because of the huge oil reserves. But in the last 10-20 years, there's been a polarization, growing social problems. It's an unstable regime. And there's conflict within the regime about which way to go forward. Some of them would like to open up, give some rights to try and appease the masses. And that's one of the reasons why they're in Iraq, as I said, because they could always go into Saudi Arabia. It's obviously backfired. Imagine invading Saudi Arabia from Iraq with the mess they've created now. A little detail. United Arab Emirates, which is one of the small Arab regimes, going through a massive boom at the moment. There's 700,000 building workers in this small country. 95% of them are Pakistanis, Indians, Sri Lankans, Bangladeshis and Nepalese. And they're facing strikes. We published an article the other day of a strike reported from a Pakistani comrade who's over there. 15,000 workers on two sites. So you can see the instability that's sort of spreading around the whole region. Then we have the Iranian regime next door to Iraq. In 1978-79, there was a revolution, a genuine workers' revolution. They created workers' councils. The oil workers were a key part of that. They brought down the Shah. Now, the Shah of Iran, it was one of the most brutal regimes, one of the most powerful armies, the SAVAK, the political police of Iran, was a feared body, and yet Once the workers moved in 78 and 79, SAVAK officials were ripping off their uniforms and getting into civilian clothes and disappearing because of the mass movement. They couldn't hold them off. The SAVAK was a body which would fly over workers' demonstrations in helicopters and machine gun them as they were demonstrating. This was the kind of regime. Eventually it was brought down. There could have been a revolution in Iran, a classical workers' revolution, but because of the Communist Party leadership, the Tudeh, and its two-stages theory, the revolution was not a social revolution, it was the democratic revolution, and the next stage was to be democratic revolution and the development of capitalism. And of course, that wasn't what happened. What happened was the revolution, because of the lack of leadership of in the working class, it was hijacked by the mullahs, who were, with their anti-imperialist rhetoric and making a lot of concessions in word to the workers' rights, filled the vacuum and hijacked the regime, hijacked the revolution, sorry, and then diverted it in the reactionary direction, arresting, torturing and killing a lot of the left-wing activists, and establishing this terrible regime which they have. But they have their own agenda, and a regime in conflict with imperialism came on the scene. And for years, they've been considered a thorn in the side, and that's why US imperialism backed Saddam Hussein in the war against Iran, where over a million people were killed in that war. And they armed Saddam Hussein, advised him, and it was an eight-year war. And the purpose was to try and destroy the regime in Iran. They failed, of course. But things are now changing in Iran, too. There is a radical move developing amongst the workers and the students. And a reflection of that was, I think it was back in December, Ahmadinejad, the president, went to Tehran University, and to show you the situation, the students ripped up posters of Ahmadinejad in front of him, shouted, "You're a fascist, and what right do you have to come and talk to the students here?" He was shocked by that, because it was a massive response of the students against him. And there is a movement of the working class in Iran. And that also explains the rhetoric of the regime. They attack Israel, they threaten Israel, they threaten the West, all the rest of it, nuclear weapons, etc. A lot of it is for domestic purposes. It's to show that, it's to divert the attention of the Iranian masses away from the real problems, which are internal. It's the regime and the economic mess that they're in. The irony of the situation is that when Iraq was stable under Saddam Hussein, from the point of view of imperialism, it was a counterweight to Iran. They've destroyed that now. Actually, they're creating a situation where Iraq could break up, at least into three chunks. Kurdistan in the north, and then the rest would be divided between Shias and Sunnis, which wasn't the case before, and it's not what imperialism wanted. But because they're weak and don't have a social base, they try to lean on different ethnic groups to get a base, using one against the other, and the result has been they've actually fomented ethnic conflict, and now you have killings, inter-ethnic killings, and the possibility of the breakup of Iraq. But what's happened now is that Iran has emerged much more powerful in the situation because of the Iraq is no longer a counterweight. In actual fact, Iran is dabbling in the internal affairs of Iraq because of the Shias, who are a large chunk of the population. But it has much wider consequences if this happens. Turkey, which is supposed to be an ally of American imperialism, and it is, has had its eyes on the north of Iraq for years, Mosul in particular, the oil fields. And the north is inhabited by the Kurds, who played a despicable role in Iraq. Because they were anti-Saddam Hussein, they supported American imperialism coming in. Now, the American imperialists will use the Kurds and dispose of them when they no longer need them. They will not allow them to have their own state because Turkey will not tolerate it. An independent Kurdistan emerging out of the north of Iraq would encourage the Kurds in Turkey, because there's a huge Kurdish area. About a third of Turkey is Kurdish, the southeast. And there's been a guerrilla war going on for years and cross-border crossings. And the Turks have already been into the north of Iraq several times with the excuse that they were pursuing the terrorists of the PKK. If the Kurds in the north of Iraq should ever break away, Turkey has said it several times, they would go in. And therefore, spreading the instability, not solving it. You see what a mess they've created. Now, I've got a lot of more notes here, but I've already spoken for quite some time, and I think I've covered most of it. But to go back to what I said at the beginning, the Iraq war and the United States. The Iraq war is now costing the USA $2 billion a week. Now, Machiavelli always pointed out that you go to war to plunder, to dominate. You don't go to destroy, you don't destroy your enemy. Wars are never about destroying your enemy, it's about conquering them and getting them to work for you and taking away their resources and creating markets, etc., etc. And it's supposed to be profitable. After the initial investment of investing in tanks and missiles and sending a couple hundred thousand soldiers, at a certain point it's supposed to start paying. The Iraq war has not been profitable at all. It's $2 billion a week. Even the most powerful nation in the world, like US imperialism, can't tolerate that. So it's not profitable. 3,500 soldiers have died already. And it's having a powerful effect inside America. American society is now divided down the middle, and it's having a polarizing effect, a radicalizing effect, even within the army itself. The troops are demoralized, even the British army, by the way. You see the way they report it on the BBC. Normally everything's okay, but there's occasionally some naughty officer who breaks discipline and leaks out the fact that, it was on the news yesterday, I don't know if you saw it, we're stretched to the limit. If Britain were attacked, it couldn't defend itself at this particular moment because it's got troops in Afghanistan, in Iraq. The morale of the troops is at rock bottom. They feel that they're there achieving nothing. They're not, the prospect of actually coming away, having left Iraq with a modern government and everything sorted, is not there. It's actually getting worse and worse. And it's having an effect, a very strong effect, in America. Now, if you consider the Daily Mail, which is not the most radical left newspaper that I've read or come across, it says, W in denial. It's quite funny how it starts. It says, what if your neighbour suddenly announced that he had spotted fairies at the bottom of the garden, or thought he was about to give birth to an elephant? You would feel sympathy for his loved ones and maybe suggest that he changed his sleeping tablets. There are lots of such people about the place, harmless and indeed often rather sweet. But when America's president, leader of the free world, displays the same symptoms, we are entitled to take fright. On Thursday, George Bush gave a press conference at the White House during which he asserted that the United States can succeed in Iraq. And it goes on and on. He says, in short, Bush remains in absolute denial. And they're comparing him to the position Nixon was in towards the end of the Vietnam War, where everybody was against and wanted the withdrawal of the troops. And Nixon was preparing to invade Cambodia, not just Vietnam. That's actually why they impeached him. Nothing to do with the lies, the tapes and that. They can always get, they've got tapes on politicians any time you want. It's like on Blair and the Lords thing, selling peerages, you know. Is that the first time this happened in British history? It's amazing, and Blair's the first one to do it. But they bring it out, a bit of dirt, whack the Labour Party in the elections. They've got all the information they want. Scandals don't erupt really because they've happened. They erupt because they happen all the time. But they get publicised and they get used when there's a political purpose to it. And in Nixon's case, it was get rid of the bastard because he's really risking the interests of US imperialism. Now, the US bourgeoisie looks more and more, they're swinging towards the idea. The Democrats have already come out in that. We've got to get out. We've got to find a way of getting out. And the problem is, now they've created a situation where, if they pull out now, can you imagine what would happen? Iran would take a chunk, Turkey would take a chunk, there'd be chaos everywhere. America would come out humiliated. How could they launch another war of this kind? Think about it also. It would probably be much more important now for the US to launch a military adventure in Venezuela than in Iraq. After all, Saddam Hussein was not threatening the property of the United States. Saddam Hussein was quite a loyal individual. Yes, he invaded Kuwait and a few other little misdemeanors like that, but he was really one of their boys, and if they'd wanted to, as they said, they've always said, if we, the oil wasn't, we can always get the oil, we can buy the oil. I mean, Iraq wants to sell its oil, for Christ's sake. It was the craziness of a wing of the American bourgeoisie. And this is actually a consequence of a much more wider historical context, which is the collapse of the Soviet Union, and East Timor, all the rest of it, China going towards capitalism, etc. In the minds of some of the most rabid reactionary elements of the American ruling class, America emerges as the sole superpower, the most powerful country we've ever seen in world history. Never have we seen such a huge, powerful economy and army. And they thought, we can do whatever we want. We can march in wherever we want and tell everybody what to do. Well, Iraq is actually proving to the people of the world that the most powerful country in the world, the most powerful army, the most powerful economy, the sole superpower, cannot control Iraq. Now, imagine they get completely smashed in Iraq. They have to go running with their tail between their legs, leaving an absolute mess in the whole region. And then somebody says, well, boys, now we've got to invade Venezuela. It wouldn't go down too well with American soldiers, American workers, and on top of it, there's a whole, it wouldn't be just Venezuela, it's the whole continent. But they are, they seriously consider, and they can't do it. Partly, the objective situation in Venezuela doesn't allow it. The Times, in the 70s, actually pointed out to the bourgeois, when it was a more serious newspaper, not what it is now, it actually said, you should never invade against the revolution at its peak. Because invading against the revolution where the masses are mobilized has the opposite effect. It radicalizes them further and pushes them to fight back. You maneuver first. You use the leaders of the labor movement over a long period to betray and demoralize. And once you've demoralized and weakened the working class, then you can, then if necessary, you can invade. Like in Chile, the coup in 1973. They couldn't carry out a coup in 1970 or 71 or 72. They did it in 73 after Allende had done dirty work for them by demoralizing the workers with his reformist policies. Therefore, in Venezuela, it wouldn't be immediate, but they're clearly considering that option at some point. The war in Iraq has weakened them on that front. And it's also, it's achieved nothing. It's costing in terms of money, in terms of capital, it's costing in terms of lives, it's costing in terms of political authority, it's costing in terms of the radicalization of the workers and youth in America. It's actually having the effect of pushing the revolution forward even in the United States itself. That is the effect that it's had. And it can only be that there was no other way they could do it because of the general state of the world economy and the whole world political situation. Everywhere, and I'll finish on this, all governments in all countries, apart from Venezuela, are applying more or less the same policies. You go to Nigeria, and I'm sitting there in the comrade's house, the news comes on, pensioners protesting outside a government office because the pensions are not being paid. Why? Because the pension fund or whatever has collapsed. Government workers on strike because of a tax on their conditions. Students protesting because of fees. If I didn't tell you which country it was, you could guess any number of countries in the world where it could be. The same in Egypt. I mentioned what's happening in Israel, what's happening in Lebanon, it's happening here in Europe, it's happening everywhere. Capitalism is in a period where it can only survive by squeezing more and more out of the workers of all countries, in every country. Directly in the workplace, by speed-ups, by keeping the wages down, etc., etc., and also indirectly by, for instance, getting people to invest their savings in stocks, in investment funds, pension funds are redirected towards the stocks. They're sucking every possible penny out of everybody's pockets towards themselves for their system because it's sick. It's a system which is in decay. For 30 years, we've had ups and downs in the economy. At the moment, we're going through what is classed as a boom. You know, there's quite a significant growth in a lot of countries, and yet after the Second World War, the boom gave us free education, grants for everybody. And I was talking to the Norwich comrades and explaining in the good old days when we had grants and you didn't have to pay to go to university. And to them it seemed like, I can't imagine a situation like that. To me it's the opposite. To me it's incredible they have to pay to go to university. So this is the situation we're in. The system is, has taken away all the reforms of the past and is taking more and more. This is squeezing the workers and of the world and the youth, and the system is breaking at the weakest points where the conditions are most intolerable. Latin America, the Middle East, and now we're seeing it also in Africa. That explains what's happening on a world level. Within this, we have the revolutionary potential. The highlight of that, obviously, is Venezuela. And beyond that, it's Bolivia and the events in Peru in the last few weeks. The occupied factories in Brazil, etc., etc. The movement of millions of immigrants in the United States. The strikes in Lebanon. The movements in Israel, etc., etc. There's reaction and revolution at the same time. And it represents the growing conflict between the classes. And that's the context within which you have to put the Middle East. And at the end of the day, of course, the key importance of the Middle East is the energy and the oil which they need to keep their system going and to keep some form of stability. Now, I've got a lot more which I could say, but I'll leave it there so the comrades can ask questions, come in, make points, or whatever.